Welcome to Body Signals, a Cygnos podcast. I'm your host, Bill Tanzer, Chief Data Scientist here at Cygnos. This is Season 1, Episode 7. Today, we have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Sunil Kolewad, the Chief of Endocrinology and Metabolism at UCSF. Dr. Kolewad is also an advisor to us here at Cygnos. On today's second part of our two-part series, we'll talk to Dr. Kolewad about how changes in blood glucose can lead to weight gain and weight loss, why conditioned athletes might have different blood glucose curves than the rest of us, why pizza and wine may not be the healthiest combination, and the exciting trend of personalized precision nutrition. The statements and opinions expressed by Dr. Kolewad on today's show are intended for educational purposes only and are not intended as medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is established by Dr. Kolewad's participation in today's show. If you have specific questions about your own health, you should consult with your physician or healthcare professional. So you mentioned glycemic response. I wondered if you could just help educate us as to how variations in blood sugar might lead to weight gain.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So glycemic responses or you know, the ability to track the upward and downward undulations of blood sugar in real time, give us a lot of insight into the utilization of glucose as a fuel in our bodies and the factors that affect the secretion and the level of insulin in the body. So, you know, very simply, our glucose levels are a function of several things. One is the consumption of food that has carbohydrates in it, clearly. The carbohydrates in the food that we eat provide a potent signal to the pancreas to make insulin. And insulin's job is to responsively address the glucose that's about to rise in the bloodstream in response to those consumed carbohydrates, which are going to be metabolized, digested, broken down into mono and disaccharides. And the most abundant monosaccharide is itself glucose. And that glucose is fuel for our body after we eat, primarily. With the excess that's not needed for our bodily needs or what's above and beyond the needs of our body, with the excess stored as a substance called glycogen in our livers and in our muscle for use as an adjunctive fuel source when we're not eating any food or have not eaten any food for a long time, especially when we're engaged in exercise or physical activity. So insulin's job is to get that glucose that is coming into our bloodstream from the food we just ate into the cells in our body that need it for fuel. And so the classic analogy that we make is that every cell has a door through which glucose can enter into that cell to be used as fuel. And those doors are locked. And insulin functions as the key to open those doors so that glucose can get into the cells and be used as a fuel. So one aspect of glucose fluctuation is the rise in glucose that occurs in response to the food that we consume and the subsequent fall in glucose that occurs in response to the action of insulin, which brings that glucose down by allowing the glucose to go from the blood into the cells of the body that will use it as fuel. Another aspect of what controls our blood sugar or glucose is what happens to glucose when we're not eating anything. And that's most notably tracked over the course of a night's sleep. If our last meal is dinner or something that we eat later in the evening, and then we don't eat anything else for the next 9 hours and we haven't yet eaten breakfast, ideally we would like our glucose to be really flat during that period. Some people have a slow, a gradual fall in glucose during that period and then a rise during the early morning hours before they eat their first meal. And some people have a rise in blood sugar during that period, suggesting that they might have a little bit of a poor responsiveness to their own body's basal levels of insulin. And therefore, then when they're really, you know, metabolically inactive, like we are when we sleep, you can see that lack of responsiveness to our body's circulating insulin with a slow rise in blood sugar. People won't normally know about any of this unless they have something that monitors that, that they can wear and tell them that your blood sugar rises while you're sleeping. And then finally, there's a lot of fluctuation that occurs in response to the things we do each day. Most notably, as an example, would be physical activity like exercise. And so if we haven't eaten in a long time and we engage in a profound, vigorous exercise, our blood sugar will fall in response to that exercise because we're increasing the rate at which cells in our body, most notably our muscles, which are really active when we exercise, are using the sugar, the glucose that's in our blood. So that utilization of glucose will make the blood sugar level fall. But what will happen when we reach a specific threshold is that all these, again, that word compensatory mechanisms kick in responsively to break down the stored glycogen in our muscle and our liver to provide glucose back into our bloodstream so our glucose doesn't fall too low. Molecules that are stored in fat tissue will be mobilized, flux in the bloodstream to the liver, and the liver will utilize that fat to produce new glucose, a process we call gluconeogenesis. And the liver will make glucose and put that glucose out into the bloodstream. So we use a variety of different approaches in the body to provide more glucose into our system when we know the glucose is falling fast, such as it does during profound, intense physical activity. And by doing this, we again protect ourselves, just like our body does to protect ourselves from specific severe weight loss. We protect ourselves from specific and severe glucose reductions that keep us vigorous, keep us alert, and keep us able to go on doing profound and prolonged physical activity, even though we haven't eaten any food in quite some time. So all of this dynamic regulation used to only be something that scientists could be aware of because we had the tools to study individuals in laboratory conditions or do the studies in rodents or other model animal systems so that we could learn all of these aspects of the dynamic regulators of our blood sugar. But now people have access to the ability to know all of this dynamic regulation about themselves. And by gaining that insight into how does my body respond to the foods I eat in terms of glucose? How does my insulin in response to the food I eat bring the blood sugar back down to normal? What happens when I'm not eating any food? Are my hormonal systems functioning normally to prevent glucose from rising over time? Or are they insufficient to prevent glucose from rising over time? And then finally, how beneficial is the type of physical activity I'm engaging in keeping my blood sugar from going up, bringing it back down, engaging those compensatory mechanisms? We can get insight into all of these things now, and we didn't have an idea about any of them other than to follow population-level expert guidance about healthy living. Now we can learn some of this stuff for ourselves, and that's provided a lot of insight to people.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, this is one of the things that Cygnos does is using a CGM or a continuous glucose monitor gives our members insight into how their glucose levels are changing throughout the day. I'd love to ask you some specific examples I've seen in not only my glucose chart, but also some of our staff and the experiments we've been doing. So one of our staff members went on a run, and she's an avid runner, and decided to do an all-out effort. I think she was doing like a sub-6-minute mile during this effort. And she did this fasted, and her blood sugar went up to 165 milligrams per deciliter during the run. I think I know the answer as to what we're seeing here, but I just want to see what your insight is.
Right. So if one's blood sugar actually goes up somewhat during a run, that can often be the function of training. And trained athletes, for example, Really good examples are people who are professionals in team sports, right? So when you're a professional in a team sport, let's say you're on the bench and you play for an NBA team. You don't know exactly when you're going in. You know you're probably going to go in at some point because you usually do. And you don't know when that's going to be. More importantly, you don't know how long you're going to stay in once you do go in. So you need to be able to give full effort, maximal physical productivity and engagement, knowing that you might go in minute two of the game and stay in for the entire duration of the game from that moment forward because there's an injury or something, or go in for 1 minute right before halftime or right before the game ends. And you don't know. You got to be ready for that full gamut. And so what do? You train. You condition to get ready for all of this realm of possibilities that might befall you during the game so that you can give full effort for the entire duration of the game if need be. Or even if they go into overtime, keep going, keep going, keep going. No fall off. And so what trained athletes do is create a physiological mechanism so that the fuel that they need to burn in order to produce that level of physical activity is actually always in abundance so that they never fall short on fuel. If you see a marathon runner, you get a very clear example of what happens when you fall short on fuel. So marathon runners are initially existing on the glycogen that they have stored in excess in their livers and in their muscle because they carbo-loaded the night before. Very traditional approach to an endurance race. And sometimes they even drink coffee because coffee helps mobilize fat from the fat tissue sooner versus later. But if you don't train well for a marathon and you don't carbo-load sufficiently, what will happen is that somewhere between miles 16 and 20, maybe mile 21, you will expend all of that stored glycogen before the fat in your fat tissue is able to be hydrolyzed. The fatty acids flow to the liver, and the liver turn that fat into glucose to supplement the glucose that is being burned from your glycogen. And if there is a gap between when you expend sufficiently your glycogen and you have not yet mobilized that fat and turned it into glucose, that gap will cause you to hit the wall. And in cycling, they call it bonking. And if you bonk or hit the wall, you've seen maybe videos of people in races who've done this. They literally will just fall right to the ground. The human body has to have some kind of fuel to keep the brain going. And if you have a gap in fuel because you're burning calories very, very, very rapidly, there's no room for error at that point. So my interpretation of your colleague's slightly elevated blood sugar during her workout is that she has trained a very robust mechanism in her liver to burn glycogen and mobilize glycogen into the bloodstream in preparation for that burning, as well as get fat from the fat tissue to the liver, convert that fat into glucose, and send that glucose through gluconeogenesis out into the bloodstream. And so she has a buffer. She has a buffer of glucose such that if she wanted to run another mile after the one she ran, she probably could do it without a decrement in her performance. And that's what training does.
So that's fascinating. What we saw in that rise was actually an indication of how fit she is and how well her body can not only adapt to the exercise, but plan for the exercise and adapt for what's
coming. That's exactly right. And so if she wore a CGM while running, she can actually see the change in the provision of that extra glucose over time during a training regimen, and actually see whether the training regimen she engages in is actually producing the outcome that she wants for her runs in a much more actionable way than she could if she did not have a CGM to assist her in that.
Fascinating. Okay, another example. Actually, I have two. One we'll get through, and then another I think that will segue perfectly into our next section. But I was wondering about this example. We had our niece over to our house a few weekends ago, and she's 9 years old. She takes a lot of energy to keep her entertained when she's visiting us. So I made pizza for her, homemade pizza, had a couple glasses of wine while I was making the pizza.
You, not your niece.
Thank you for clarifying.
There we go.
Yes, that was me. And by the way, my wife did not have any wine. So we did have somebody who did not Perfect. Have any wine watching the kid.
All good.
Thank you. I'd had this pizza before and I didn't alter the ingredients at all. When I had had it without the wine, I noticed I had a pretty significant increase in my glucose. Went to like 180 within 30, 40 minutes of eating the pizza. With the wine, I didn't see that spike for like 2+ hours after I ate the pizza. Any idea what was happening there?
Yeah, that's an interesting example. So there's two things there that I think are learning issues. One has to do with the pizza, mm-hmm. and one has to do with the wine. So with respect to the pizza, one thing that's really interesting about a food like that that's got complicated macronutrient composition involving some protein, depending on what's on the pizza, a lot of carbohydrate because of the crust as well as the cheese, and a lot of fat because the cheese is really replete in fat as well as the oil that was in the dough that was used to make the crust. So one of the things that that is really notable about glucose rise is that really simple carbohydrates, the most notoriously simple carbohydrates being sugar-sweetened beverages, which are essentially like injecting glucose straight into your system because they absorb so rapidly across the intestinal wall. When you eat simple carbohydrates, blood sugar goes up very rapidly. And the impact on insulin to bring it back down is really abrupt and robust. And that's one reason why we ask people not to eat, refined, simple carbohydrates in excess or chronically, because it puts a lot of strain on the pancreas to make insulin very rapidly over one's lifetime. But when you couple carbohydrates with fat, what fat does is slow the rate of emptying of nutrients from the stomach. And so the same amount of carbohydrates mixed with fat actually enter the bloodstream slower than those carbohydrates would have on their own. The fat slows the entry process. So there's a very characteristic rate of rise of blood sugar when people eat foods like pizza that is a little bit slower than if people ate the same amount of carbohydrates, but just as like white bread without any fat in the mix. So pizza has its own pattern of blood glucose rise that's different from, you know, what might be the case if you ate a bowl of white rice or something much more simple with respect to the carbohydrates. Now, separately, you asked about, okay, well, what about the impact of the glass of wine? So wine, alcohol, it being the element here in question, has a specific impact in this case on the liver. And chronically, we think about alcohol or alcohol abuse as being damaging to the liver. But I'm not talking about that. I'm saying even in the context of a normal, moderate level of acute consumption, like you had with a glass with dinner, alcohol affects master regulators of glucose and fat metabolism in the liver. The liver is an amazing integration center in the body. It is a center that dictates the utilization, the storage, and the provision to the rest of the body under different hormonal circumstances and in response to consumption of food or the lack of consumption of food for a long time, so that the body has a continuous array of fuel sources for its needs. And the liver is the integration site that does all that connecting of our body's needs with the availability of food and fuel to our hormonal state. And the two fuels in question are fat and sugar or glucose. The liver stores both fat and glucose, and the liver makes both fat and glucose, and the liver provides fat and glucose back to the body for its use in all tissues throughout the body, depending on what type of fuel they prefer to use. So the liver is just an amazing center in the body that dictates our total energy metabolism in the body as a whole. Now, what alcohol does is one thing in particular. It promotes fat synthesis through the activation of a transcriptional pathway, a pathway that governs the regulation upward and downward of a number of different genes that control, in this case, aspects of fat metabolism. And alcohol shifts that balance vis-a-vis this transcriptional regulatory mechanism towards the synthesis of fat. So when you consume alcohol, the glucose that goes into your body through the meal, more of that glucose is converted into fat and stored in the liver. And so the rate of rise and the rapidity of rise of blood glucose from the carbohydrates you consumed in that pizza, some of that was siphoned towards the production of fat, and that fat stayed in the liver. So the energy from that pizza, some of it ended up in your liver as fat, whereas only a portion of it ended up in your bloodstream as glucose. And more of it would have ended up in your bloodstream as glucose had you not consumed the alcohol along with the meal.
Wow. So I'm guessing one of those lifestyle changes you might ask me to make would not be having a glass of wine with my meals, because we don't want extra fat stored in the liver.
That's right. And so one of the things that we ask people to do who have fatty liver disease, and fatty liver disease is a very common consequence of obesity for certain people, depending on their genetic predisposition, is to moderate, if not abstain, from alcohol consumption, because alcohol fuels fat synthesis in the liver, and fat synthesis in the liver can lead to inflammation in the liver, which we call non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, if it's just a function of obesity in one's genetics, which can then lead to fibrosis in the liver, and then even a risk for cirrhosis. And fatty liver disease is becoming rapidly the number one reason for liver transplant in the United States. And understanding the relationship between alcohol consumption chronically and liver fat can help people mitigate the risk for that progression over time if they know about it.
Got it. So the next example I want to present to you, this is something we've done internally with our staff. We do some anecdotal experiments just to test out some things. We were studying resistant starch, but we didn't quite get there before we stumbled upon this finding. So I asked everyone on the staff to eat one cup of cooked white rice, freshly cooked white rice, fasted first thing in the morning. The responses from the staff in terms of what happened to their glucose ranged from some of our staff spiking to like 220 milligrams per deciliter in their blood sugar from, you know, a baseline of 80, to my own response, which I went from 80 to 90. So virtually no response. And this, I think, points to the heterogeneity of our own responses to foods. Just wondered if you could give us some insight as to why we saw such a different response. And it wasn't just the rice. We did the next week, we did potatoes, and same thing. I spiked a lot on that where others didn't spike quite
so high. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting about it is that on its face, these kind of empiric data capture experiments fly in the face of so-called expert guidelines, or CDC and other federal food pyramid or healthy eating or healthy plate kind of guidance. The guidance about restricting refined simple carbohydrates, focusing on lean sources of protein, if not vegetarian sources of protein, minimizing the consumption of red meat, minimizing the consumption of saturated fat, and focusing on mono and healthy polyunsaturated fats like omega-3 fats, for example, from fish and from legumes and olive oil, other vegetarian sources of monounsaturated fats. All of these guidances come from studies that are examining large cohorts of individuals, if not populations of individuals, in aggregate. So in aggregate, a cup of white rice elevates people's blood sugar on average much more robustly and much more rapidly than a cup of brown rice would, or a cup of high fiber cereal, even if the total amount of carbohydrates being consumed are equal. That's where this idea of the glycemic index comes from. The problem is that within that guidance based on aggregated data from large cohorts of individuals studied together is a lot of inter-individual variability. And there have been some very seminal studies that have shown this inter-individual variability, and those studies are now seminal to our understanding of what we call precision nutrition or individualized nutritional responses. And it's, at the end of the day, the precise, personalized, individual response to a specific consumed nutrient that I want to know about. I want to know about my response, not the aggregate response that might be seen if a population is studied. That gives me some insight, but my own response at the end of the day is what I care about. And so there are two types of interesting aspects to this. One is that traditionally so-called unhealthy foods, like let's just say in your example of a cup of freshly cooked white rice, traditionally it's put to the population as being something to avoid consuming in excess because it causes a rapid and profound rise in blood sugar when you eat it. Within that guidance, it is absolutely the case that some people don't have that response. They're much better able to eat foods like that without seeing that glycemic rise, and therefore they don't get the stress on the pancreatic beta cells to produce insulin responsively like other people might. And so for them, white rice isn't the culprit that we say it is to society as a whole. On the other hand, you can look at all kinds of foods. In fact, some foods that we think of or at least put forward as profoundly healthy. For example, in the initial cell paper from the Weizmann Institute, where they looked at this in the context of some statements about people's intestinal microbiome or the composition of the microbes that live commensally in our guts, they found that people could eat foods like, for example, tomato. Not foods that we think of as being profoundly unhealthy, but for some individuals studied one-off each on their own responses, for some individuals, they had a very profound rise in blood sugar when they ate tomato, whereas most people didn't have any response at all. And so that's something else that people would want to look out for, because even though this is a food that's healthy at the population level, they may want to avoid eating it in excess or eating it chronically, because for that person, it somehow makes their blood sugar rise. Now, that Weizmann Institute study implicated the microbiome as a mediator of this inter-individual variability. And the microbiome might do this because of several reasons. One is that the microbiome interacts with the nutrients we eat, because those microbes live in our intestine. They see the food that we eat before we see the food that we eat in many ways. And they therefore then may determine the rate at which the nutrients that we consume enter our bloodstream and the level that those nutrients rise in our bloodstream after they're consumed. Furthermore, by interacting with the nutrients we consume, the microbiome may make other factors that enter our bloodstream, and those factors, whether they are short-chain fatty acids or other metabolites secondary to the processing of the nutrients that the microbes interact with themselves, those metabolites also may have an impact on our blood sugar. And finally, our host response to our own microbiome in the context of the food that we just ate may be unique to us. And that host response, whether it's because of immunologic factors, immune cells that live in the lining of our intestines that produce cytokines and other mediators of human physiology, those host factors may be different from one person to the next and may really dictate the glucose response that we have when we eat a specific kind of food. And so, you know, at the end of the day, having a CGM-based approach to monitor what one eats is, today at least, the only way that we can get this kind of end-of-the-line insight into what the glycemic response is for us, for me as an individual, to all these different foods I might eat or choose between when I decide what I want to eat.
And so to just circle back to the beginning of our conversation, when you talked about making some lifelong changes, it doesn't have to be as ominous as reducing whole categories of macro food macros. It can be much more precise, which I think was the point of your UCSF talk, which is using our own individual glycemic response to find the foods that work for us, don't work for us. So if I'm maybe considering keto, I don't have to eliminate all fruit. I can test the fruits and have all the benefits of healthy foods, healthy fruits, and find those that maybe don't spike me as much as other fruits.
That's right? Exactly right. I think you stated it perfectly. You can understand the dietary regimen in a very precise way just by connecting the foods that you eat in a sequential or organized way with your glycemic response, which you can measure in real time. And by that, you can really understand the food choices that you make, the nutrients you choose, and the foods that you like, in terms of their relationship to your body's physiology, like they're also part of a pharmacy that you can choose from for specific needs. And you can even get more granular, because you can then connect that relationship, i.e. the relationship of a specific nutrient or food with a specific glycemic response, with your plans for physical activity prior to and following that meal. And you can create customized relationships between what you want to do, what you want to eat, when in the day you want to eat it, and how much of it you want to eat, all based on an understanding of what each of those combinatorial scenarios do to your blood sugar for every single nutrient you want to consider. And again, this can allow you to eat all kinds of foods that you love at all kinds of times of the day and night that you enjoy eating those foods, with an understanding that you're protected or getting the response that you're seeking to get. And that's what we really think of when we say precision nutrition.
I'm so glad you said that, especially the part about the physical activity. Another experiment we did was had everybody drink an 8-ounce glass of orange juice and then find an exercise to mitigate the pending glucose spike from that glass of orange juice. The big learning there, we all knew that we were going to see a spike because it's orange juice, form of liquid sugar, a lot of the fibers removed when you just press a fruit and drink its juice. What I didn't expect was how quickly that orange juice would enter my system versus other foods that I might eat. So I failed the first experiment, didn't mitigate at all because I had the glass of orange juice and I waited 20 minutes before getting on a treadmill. Second time, I actually had the glass sitting next to the treadmill, drank it, and got on, started running right away and completely mitigated the spike. Other people had different responses in terms of the time. So it really is precision nutrition, not just about the foods we eat, but about the physical activity, our own body's reaction to that specific food, the timing of when we should exercise, how much exercise we need to do. I think all of this, it sounds like a lot, but what it boils down to is that you can make these small changes in your lifestyle, lasting changes versus a diet that is meant to be a quick fix. You can make these small changes that are lasting and really not that difficult to make.
That's right. I'll add one more detail, because I agree with everything you said. And that is, people might ask, well, you know, we're so complex. There's so many variables that we could measure. Why is it the case that measuring just our glucose is sufficient to capture that complexity? Well, you could think of, you know, an array of hormones, an array of nutrients, an array of immunological factors, biorhythms, measuring our skin impedance and all kinds of other factors that you might want to be able to measure in parallel, and then have some kind of computing system that, you know, integrated all of those different variables and gave us a readout, if you will. Well, that's aspirational. But the reason why a CGM makes so much sense is because of the centrality of glucose to human physiology. It's at the center of everything our body does, and everything our body needs, from the cognitive to the physical. And so to understand all the factors that influence the levels of glucose in the blood, and of course, measuring it in the blood versus some other fluid, I mean, the blood is also quite powerful, and having a glucose monitor that allows an assessment of what the blood glucose is quite powerful, because all of these places in the body where glucose is used, they end up extracting that glucose from the blood. And so you're basically measuring the central single molecule, if you will, for human physiology in the place where that measurement matters the most. And that's why, as a single variable, it is so insightful in connecting all of these behaviors and patterns of nutrient intake to one another.
Dr. Kolawat, thank you so much for coming on our show today. If anyone wants to follow your work, is there a place that they can go to see what you're working on?
Sure. Yeah. I'm a member of the UCSF Diabetes Center, and you can go on to the UCSF Diabetes Center's website, find my lab, and check out what we're doing. I'm also, as chief of the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism, involved in running several clinical studies, which we're always recruiting for. And we'd love to hear from folks if they're interested in learning more about our clinical studies. And they can check us out through the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism. And finally, our lab has its own website. You can check out the Kolawat Lab through UCSF and find out exactly what we're up to and who our lab members consist of and the cool stuff that we do and the fun we have. So feel free to check us out through any of those mechanisms. And you can reach out to me by email if need be as well, if you have any ideas or want other advice.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Kolawat. It was a pleasure having you on.
Our pleasure is mine. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you for joining us today on Body Signals. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like, review, and subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Instagram at Signos Health. And if you're interested in becoming a Signos member, go to signos.com on the web to request early access. Until next time.